Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. Archive programs are available on our website, WGTD.org, and you're invited to continue the discussion on the Education Matters Facebook page. This is WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. You're listening to Community Matters, a program that highlights various local issues and organizations. It's co-hosted by Len Iaquinta, a nonprofit manager, fundraiser, and consultant, WGTD Walworth County correspondent Jim McClure, and by Linda Fleshinsky, a mother, grandmother, freelance writer, and former Racine School Board president. And now, here's today's host.
Good morning. This is Len Iaquinta, and our topic today is poverty, poverty and near poverty in Walworth, Racine, and Kenosha counties. And we have some new data that's been in the newspapers this past week. It's called ALICE, Asset Limited Income Constrained Employed. And we're going to find out what that means, and we're going to be speaking with the Chief Professional Officer or Executive Director of the United Way of Racine, and that's Rodney Prunty. Good morning, Rodney.
Good morning.
Thank you for being with us today on such a newsworthy topic.
Absolutely.
Now, let's just quickly review this study, which was done by the United Ways and pulled together by the United Ways of Wisconsin in coordination with data gathered from a number of sources, takes a look at how many people are in poverty and near poverty in the state of Wisconsin. And I think the headline this week was that in spite of the economic recovery in the country and in southeast Wisconsin, in our tri-county listening area of WGTD, things have not significantly improved for people. And large numbers of people are in poverty and are barely able to survive, and the tiniest fluctuation in their income or an illness or a car breakdown can throw them into poverty or even onto the streets. Was that your biggest takeaway from the news?
Absolutely. And it's just so difficult for people. And I think you really lifted it up that there are so many folks in our state and in our communities and counties who are just one significant event away from getting thrown right back into poverty. And I think what really dispels a lot of myths around poverty and these ALICE households is that these are people that we see every day. And these are actually people that we need in our economy, whether it is folks who take care of our kids in the daycares or housekeeping staff at hotels. These are people, real people, who are working hard, but, again, struggling to make ends meet.
As I get it, the top-level thought is that cost of living keeps going up. Wages are stagnant or sometimes even go down. No matter how many hours you work, in many cases, you cannot possibly support yourself.
Exactly. And it's because a lot of people who fall within the ALICE threshold in poverty, they're working more than one job. They're working two and in some cases three jobs. And so when you are in that cycle, not only is it difficult to get out of it, because how do you even have time to look for work that you could get a higher wage or get an education so that you can improve yourself? You're just kind of stuck into that rut of you're just working just to survive.
There is a national organization that talks about housing affordability, and they have a nice map of the U.S. And if you click on Wisconsin, it says that for a one-wage earner household of, say, husband, wife, two small kids looking in a two-bedroom apartment, in the state of Wisconsin, you'd have to make $16.52 an hour for a 40-hour week to be able to afford that.
Mm.
Okay? And if you're working at a minimum wage, you would have to be working 91 hours a week to afford that. To me, this dispels a lot of the really horrible canards I hear about people saying, oh, if they would only work harder or get another job, or they're so lazy, or all the excuses people who are well off make for ignoring people who aren't.
Yeah. And that's what's so valuable about this study, because as you've just cited, it is not what people believe. It totally dispels those myths around laziness or not working hard enough. I mean, again, these are people who are doing what they believe and what really is the right thing in terms of pulling themselves up by their bootstraps, trying to get employment, to work. They're working more than one job, two jobs, and again, as I said before, some cases three. And all they want to do is support their families and contribute to the economy, but they can't catch up.
And I'm old enough to remember that back in the 1950s, when we were in the midst of the Cold War, we used to distinguish ourselves from the bad old Soviet Union by saying, we don't force women to go to work. We allow them to stay home and take care of their children for a couple of years if they so desire. Not that they should or have to, but if they so desire. We have a situation now where for many families, that puts them in an intolerable bind. You can't afford day care for your kids on this kind of a budget. You can't stay home and not work. And if you do stay home, what are those implications? It seems to me it's a no-win situation for so many people who don't have the highest of education and the highest of opportunity and also the best of luck.
Absolutely. And some politicians have called this the poverty trap, where in some cases, some people may actually believe that it's more advantageous not to work and to receive certain benefits, because otherwise they will be losing or be on the losing end if they try to work or work more often. And so that's the tension that's kind of between all of that.
That's a very important point. At many conferences I've been to recently over the last few years, it's been stressed that some of the criticisms of the working poor are unjustified and fail to realize that their reactions are rational in an irrational system.
Very, very true.
Now let's take a look at some numbers, and I urge people who really care about this general issue, and housing affordability, of course, is a big part of it, as is the cost of living, is to go online and look for the ALICE report, and it's available through the United Ways and through the United Way of Wisconsin. If you just Google ALICE, A-L-I-C-E, Wisconsin, 2016, you'll find a number of references to it. And there's a nice executive summary and charts that detail various counties and various cities. So we're not going to do a lot of numbers, but we're going to talk about some of them because it's important to understand it. Here's the top level for the state of Wisconsin. In 2016, well into the recovery, 873,000 households, 37.5% of the households in Wisconsin, couldn't afford basic needs such as housing, childcare, food, transportation, and health care. That's a third. That's a third. And that's despite of reports of overall improvement in employment and higher median incomes and the general economic recovery in Wisconsin. Of course, statewide it's been uneven, we know that. But lots of families face challenges from low wages, depleted savings, and as the report notices, the increasing cost of basic household goods. The total number of Wisconsin households that can't afford basic needs actually increased 5% during the recovery between 2010 and 2016. That's pretty significant. What does that tell you from the standpoint of the executive director of Racine County, Mr. Prunty?
Well, from my perspective, it just clearly demonstrates we're not doing enough and that we are not thinking enough about this population. And I think, again, it's easy to, you know, wave it away and say those people or put them into a different category. But here's the reality that really struck home with me when I read the very first ALICE report that came out a couple of years ago. This is our second report that's come out, is that we do need to have these people in our economy, so they can't be removed from the economy. People have to do some of these jobs that just don't pay well. And so what do we do to try to help them, right? Whether it is the services that United Way provides or even people or employers thinking differently about how they can support ALICE. I mean, you know, this summary that you're referencing, it says here that, you know, 62% of all jobs are paying less than $20 an hour in the state of Wisconsin. And so it goes back to the wage issue. It goes back to how do we help support people.
That's right. If it's odd that we have a political movement for a $15 an hour minimum wage, but that in the state of Wisconsin won't support the average family of four. It's a $1.52 short. In some places it might work, but not here. Well, there's some other interesting things just sort of on a statewide basis. What about the cost of living since 2010 to 2016? The cost of the family budget living in the state of Wisconsin increased 18% during that period. That was twice the national rate of inflation of 9%. I don't know anybody, professional, executive, or a working stiff whose income went up 18%.
Yeah, I don't know many
people.
Do
you know any of those people?
No.
I don't either. Low-wage jobs continue to dominate the employment landscape, as you said, and with more contract work and gig-type jobs, this could get even worse. Public assistance provides less support to ALIS households because their income is above eligibility needs, so public assistance, traditional public assistance, based on the federal poverty level, doesn't really help much. And the trends for the future, which I won't go into now, but we might return to later, don't look much better. Mm. Now, I'd like to talk about some of our counties. Let's take a look at our counties. Rodney, do you want to give us the data for the three counties that we're most interested in here in our listing area, Racine, Kenosha, and Walworth, what their percentage of ALIS income insecure plus the poverty rate people would add up to? That's two groups.
Sure.
People who meet the federal poverty standard, and then that extra group that really is in poverty, but not according to the federal standard, which to me is a meaningless number.
Sure. So in Racine County, we have 27% of those ALIS households, which was the last category you described that really should be classified as in poverty, but go above the arbitrary federal poverty line. That's 27%, and that's higher than the state average of 25.8%. There's 13% poverty households in Racine County, which is higher than the state average of 11.7%. So if you total them all together, so total ALIS and poverty in Racine County is 40%.
That's almost half for the entire county.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, let's move on. Pick another county.
Sure. Well, in Kenosha County, you have 25% ALIS households and 13% poverty households, making the total ALIS and poverty 38%. So that's right in line with what the state average is, 37.5%. And in Walworth County, you see 25% ALIS households, 14% poverty households. So total ALIS in poverty is 39%. What's interesting about Walworth County is that from 2010 to 2016, those ALIS households increased from 20% to 25% over the course of 6 years. So that was a big increase. And as I was looking at the data, it really surprised me. Not so much because it's increased, because if you look at the overall data, it tells you that. But to see that specifically in Walworth County was somewhat of a surprise for me.
It's definitely a statistically significant increase you would expect, wouldn't you?
Yes.
Now, let's talk a little bit more about what this ALIS thing means. Can we get into that? What's the difference between the federal poverty level and ALIS? There's something called the Household Survival Budget. And that calculates the costs of the basic needs. Housing, childcare, food, transportation, a smartphone to your business, adjusted for the different counties and household types. That's the survival budget. And the ALIS threshold is the household survival budget for each household. So it's more than the federal poverty standard, because what the United Ways have basically recognized is that the federal poverty number is a meaningless number in terms of people's lives.
Mm-hmm, absolutely. And this household survival budget really lifts that up. I mean, if you were to, so the federal poverty line is what? It's 200% of poverty. For you to, anything under that, you get services and support and things like that from the federal government. Well, you're looking at ALIS, they're 250% of the federal poverty line. So again, as we've talked about, that pushes them outside the realm or the eligibility to get these critical services. And so when you look at what it takes just to survive, it is not for the faint of heart in terms of what that budget really means. And again, any incident can throw a person who is above the poverty line in that ALIS threshold right back into poverty. And it happens, unfortunately, more than we would like it to.
One of the things that has impressed me being involved with reporting on and advising some of the human service agencies that work with the homeless in our community is that there is a tremendous misunderstanding of the individuals who do become homeless, and it cuts across every class, education, background line you can think of. And from your standpoint, being at sort of the top of the service delivery chain in the private sector side of human services in Racine County. How does that seem to you, Rodney? This isn't just, you know, it's still those people. It could be anyone you know in your circle of friends, professional or working an hourly job. Isn't that true?
That's very true. And in fact, when you're saying this, it just reminds me of a circumstance that the executive director of one of our local homeless shelters shared with me, where, you know, she indicated that out of the population of homeless people that she was housing, probably in the area of about 30 to 35% were there because they just didn't have enough money to live on their own, and that these people were actually working, and that for whatever reason their checks were being garnished for a variety of different reasons, and it didn't leave them with enough money to sustain themselves in their own housing. And so you have people getting up every day who live in a homeless shelter, going to work, working hard, and then getting off work and going right back to the homeless shelter. So there's, again, 30 to 35% of that population in Racine falls into that category.
I had a very interesting conversation earlier this year with an individual who is an important civic leader and very well wired into the business community. And we sat down and talked at a reception, and the individual said, "You know, Len, I was so surprised to learn of the amount of poverty in our public school system. Do you know that in some of our schools, half or 85% of the kids on federal subsidized lunch programs?" He said, "I was just astonished to find that out, because all of the businessmen I talk to are saying they're looking for workers. They're saying they can't hire enough workers. I hear people saying they're turning down lines of business and or buying robots because they can't find the people, and that they're paying higher wages than they ever have before." But when I took a look at what's going on in our schools here in Kenosha, this was in Kenosha, the individual said that, "I'm shocked. I had no idea. There's a real disconnect in our public policy thinking and the reality on the ground, isn't there?"
Oh, definitely, definitely. And as we've been talking about, I mean, there are so many people that have these significant challenges that, for whatever reason, because of the fact that it's easier to just categorize them, again, as those people, or they don't want to work or whatever, that people do not take into account that, yes, a lot of these folks, they have children and they want the best for their children. And these children, they're, again, homeless, struggling. And how do you focus? How do you even function academically if all you're thinking about is, where are you going to sleep tonight?
Let's stick with that for a minute or two, Rodney. You know, back when I started my career professionally in the 60s, we didn't know what we do now. And it seems to me that people in leadership, in civic leadership and in public policy leadership and the human services movement and in philanthropy, need to think very, very seriously about what we now know about the effects of poverty, especially the effects of poverty in childhood, and how pervasive, how deep, and how long-lasting the bad effects are of poverty at that low an age. And the fact that we now know gives us a responsibility that we used to be able to avoid in 1965. But in 2019, can we still continue to turn our heads the other way?
I don't think we can, as responsible leaders in our communities. Once you have knowledge and once you know, the responsibility is yours to take action on it in the best way that you can. You know, we've talked a lot about certainly the challenges that our state is experiencing in reference to ALICE and folks who live in poverty, but, you know, the United Ways are working hard to try to address some of these issues.
Let's talk about that a little bit. And we're not suggesting that there's an easy solution to any of this. It's not a snap and get it done. If it were that easy, it would have been solved a long time ago. But these are issues that we do need to address, because they're not going to go away by themselves, and the trend lines aren't very, very good.
Exactly. And again, this work's not for the faint of heart. Things aren't going to change and turn around overnight. I mean, it took us a long time to get here. It's going to take us a long time to kind of move out of it. But for what we're doing at United Way of Racine County, for example, is when we focus on financial stability for adults and families, we have a program called Advancing Family Assets, in which we fund a number of organizations to carry out. We actually started that model, built that model back in 2009 internally, and then we started funding agencies once we perfected the model. But it's pretty simple. What it is that these are life coaches or financial stability coaches who work with families to get their credit scores improved, to basically, and it's a total family approach. So it's just not the parent being case managed. They set goals for the children and everything else, and they work to kind of coach them through all the different kind of services necessary to get them on track to financial stability. So that's one of the things we're doing. One of the other things that's happening is, and this is also true in Kenosha County, is there's a program called VITA, which is Volunteer Income Tax Assistance. This is a program that helps people who make less than $54,000 a year get their taxes done for free. And that's so beneficial because when you talk about Alice families and you're struggling, you need to get as much resources, as much money into your household as possible, as fast as possible. And what happens is around tax time, you go to these places, you pay $200-$300 or a third or a half of your tax return just so you can get it back in a couple weeks so you can pay off some bills. Well, this program helps families retain all of their tax return, increasing their wealth and getting them on the path of financial stability.
Well, these are great examples of how the human services sector, working with the county human services departments that are funded from a variety of sources with mainly state and federal pass-through money, can help. And, of course, there are larger systemic changes that are necessary in public policy, too. And we're not going to try to get into those today. But what we are wanting to get into and what I think is really important for our Community Matters listeners to know is to know what the facts are. Because until you understand the facts, just like my friend who's this civic leader here in Kenosha, until that individual understands the facts, how can that person do anything to solve the problem if you don't have the right frame in which to look at it? So this Alice stuff is really important, and a reformation of the federal poverty level is also really important in my estimation as well. There's a figure in this table in this report that takes a look at the largest cities and towns that are above 20,000 households in our state of Wisconsin. And we've got a couple of our cities on this report. Let's take a look at what we see for Kenosha and Racine. Mr. Prunty, why don't you take us through that?
So what you see here in terms of this table is you have the largest cities and towns above 20,000 households. So you have Kenosha, which basically shows it at 44% of households below the Alice threshold in 2016, which was a change between 2010 and 2016 of negative 7% in terms of those households below the Alice threshold. And in Racine, the city of Racine, 60% Alice in poverty. And then that basically was a 9%, showing a 9% change between 2010 and 2016. So it really speaks to, when you look at the cities, that it's much more concentrated as opposed to the counties when it comes to Alice and poverty.
And on balance, the whole southeastern quarter with Wisconsin is about the same, with slightly worse, if you include Walworth County too, which is very interesting. Now, before we get into some more county-specific data and talk about the counties a little bit more specifically individually, Rodney, I wonder if we could talk about the fast growth that's going on. You know, after the last census, we knew that Kenosha, Racine, Walworth counties were going to be the fastest growing area of the state, that we'd be overtaking Green Bay soon, Kenosha being the third largest city soon, I guess, in the state. And then all this development on I-94 started happening after the last census and with increasing rapidity. And then, Foxconn. They just put up some walls on Thursday, and they're continuing to erect that building now as we speak. So what does that mean in terms of you thinking about the future and meeting the needs of the people you serve in Racine? What does the arrival of Foxconn mean? Does this mean all our problems are solved now?
No, actually, it it doesn't. Now, it is certainly something to be excited about when it comes to the actual possibilities surrounding Foxconn and what it can mean for our region. So on one hand, you kind of have mixed emotions. You're, on one hand, you're excited, but on the other hand, you're concerned because there are going to be effects of that, and there are going to be unintended consequences of this big shift, this big boom. And so a lot of it is relative to housing. Where are you going to put people? How does that change the affordability of housing? And so, you know, United Way and some other leaders in the community are looking at how do we address this issue where we already feel as though we are somewhat behind when it comes to affordable housing and housing, because what we don't want to do is have a situation that's created where our homeless population increases because people are being pushed out of their units or their homes because of the fact that you're going to have landlords and raising the rent, right? They're going to be raising what it costs for people to live. And so that's one of the concerns we really have, and we're really starting to have some serious discussions about.
It seems like that is just one of the problems that is going to have unintended consequences, just the affordable housing. The Green Bay Conference on Housing I was at earlier in the summer produced a very interesting tidbit for me. I started hearing the term workforce housing a lot by the secretary of one of the departments of the state of Wisconsin, and I questioned her. I said, well, what's the difference between workforce housing and affordable housing? And there really is no definition of workforce housing that I understand, so could you explain it to us? And what ensued was basically an admission that workforce housing is a cover for affordable housing to accommodate people like the employees that are going to be needing a place to live and working at Foxconn. And it's considered to be more palatable to talk about workforce housing than affordable housing or low-income housing. But I stressed that I thought that that had a very dangerous aspect to it, that we will forget about the need for affordable housing for low-income people in the rush to provide workforce housing. And as important as that is, as you said, if the rents keep rising, and they are rising around southeastern Wisconsin, and landlords can make more money renting to someone who earns more, then why wouldn't they do that?
Right.
So what is – and when I talked to the city planner of Kenosha, who's retiring at the end of the year, on this program a couple of Saturdays ago, he saw no outlook for real large numbers of affordable housing being built. He didn't see where the economic incentive could possibly be for building so-called affordable housing, because it wouldn't be considered affordable by the builders.
Right.
So unless our community comes together, many sectors of the communities in southeastern Wisconsin may be thinking regionally, oh my gosh, I don't understand how this problem can be solved. What will keep it from getting worse?
Well, I think you're right. Doing nothing, that is exactly what will happen. It will get significantly worse. But I would say that one of the aspects about Racine County that I can speak to in particular that I think gives me hope is that we have a situation where we have a mayor and a county exec who are working shoulder to shoulder. We have a spirit of collaboration throughout our community that I haven't seen in my lifetime. Which is a good place to start. So then how do we look at, to your point, pulling together these other entities, nonprofits, for-profit, developers, service providers? How do we create a system or a structure where it is basically aligned, and, you know, you have folks who are providing, you know, rental assistance, rental support, landlords, all these different folks who need to be at the table, really working to really try to solve this problem in a meaningful, comprehensive, and integrated way. And that's what it's going to have to take, because it's not going to happen on its own, for sure. We know that.
I don't know whether this is the sort of thing that county boards and city councils are well equipped to do. It seems to me like it really requires leadership and sort of a blue ribbon commission that gets put together and gets the highest level support from the top civic and political leadership in the area for that to really happen in the most organized way. I think you're right. I have a long history in this area, although I was away for a long time. I've been back for 19 years now, and I think that we are at an era right now where the opportunity for intergovernmental cooperation and the will is probably higher than it's been any time I can remember.
Absolutely.
And that's a good thing.
Yes.
I'd like to turn now with Mr. Rodney Prunty, the Chief Executive Officer of the United Way of Racine, to the poverty issues in our counties a little bit more specifically. The asset-limited, income-constrained, and employed plus official federal poverty rate in Racine County. Why don't we take a look at that in detail next and talk a little bit about what you see from that standpoint at the county level, Rodney?
Sure. So, again, as I said earlier, when we look at what's happening in Racine, Racine County, we have seen increases in Alice from 25% to 27% over time, while, interestingly enough, the poverty rate shifted a little bit from 14% to 13%. So, I mean, essentially, you're going to say that that's flat. But when we look at, the percentage of folks who are ALICE, when you break it out by household types, by income, if you see here on the chart, it pretty much spells out that single or cohabitating individuals are 28% of ALICE and 10% of poverty. So that's 38%. If you look at families with children, you see the same thing, 38%. And here's something that's very interesting. Seniors, 65 and over, 49% ALICE and poverty combined.
Yeah, I'm a senior, and that luckily I'm not in that situation. I'm very fortunate. But the baby boomers are coming. I'm just a year or so ahead of the baby boomer generation. So what's that going to mean?
Well, that means we have to do what we can to help this population. And again, what you said earlier is so true. Talking about facts, getting the information out so that people can understand. Because again, there's a certain type of person that people have in their minds when they think about poverty and whatever that situation may be. Again, whether it is folks who don't want to work, don't want to pull themselves up by their bootstraps. But these are people, these are seniors, 65 and over, 49% in our county, who have done the right thing. They've worked their job. They've had their families. They supported their families. And now they find themselves in a situation where now sometimes they have to decide between, do I buy food or medication? And that shouldn't happen.
It's very interesting to look at what the household survival budget, which is really a very bare bones budget, what that would be county by county, and the household survival budget for Racine County is calculated on two adults, one infant, and one preschooler for a family, and that's very interesting. It's an annual total budget of $69,000. Mm-hmm. And for a single adult, the survival budget is just under $23,000. So that means that a single adult's hourly wage would have to be $11.37 to meet that. And the wage owner in the small family would have to be earning $34.43 an hour.
Right.
In order to do that, if they were only working a 40-hour job, which we used to think was being okay. What does that tell you about the need for services and where the direction we need to be going in our United Ways?
Well, again, this is why we focus on fighting for the health, education, and financial stability of every person in our community. Last one, financial stability. We have to focus on becoming intentional about how we help provide support. So when you were talking about that, the two adults, one infant, one preschooler, $69,000 a year just to survive, right? And so that's $34 an hour if you were to look split between two people. But here's the other piece that's alarming. There are a lot of people, and particularly in the city of Racine, so you're talking about single-headed households with children, two or more, whatever it may be. So that means that they would still need to be making this kind of money, a little bit less because it's one less adult in the house, but still a significant amount of money, more than we would believe, in order to just survive. And so this tells us we need to become much more focused on our efforts of getting people into financial stability and to provide avenues and supports so that people can move up the ladder to economic mobility. And we just haven't done enough of that, not with intention.
The picture in Kenosha County, you want to take a look at that for us, Mr. Prunty?
Well, sure. So similar to what we talked about before, we've seen that the percentage of ALIS has actually, interesting in Kenosha, has declined a few percentage points from 29% to 25%. However, poverty increased from 12% to 13%.
And that's just in a six-year period from 2010 to 2016, isn't it?
Yes, absolutely. And then if you break it out by household types by income, you'll see that for single or cohabitating individuals, it's about 25% ALIS, 10% in poverty, so 35% total ALIS in poverty. Families with children, you have 18% that would be ALIS, and then 21% in poverty, so that's 39% ALIS in poverty. And again, seniors, 35% who are ALIS and 8% in poverty, but that's 43% ALIS in poverty. So what we've seen here in just these two examples, and we'll get to Walworth County, is that the biggest population of ALIS, seniors, if you break it out.
So if you're in a senior center, you look to the left, you look to the right of you, probably one or both of those people are in poverty. And the household survival budget for Kenosha County, is it about the same? It looks like it is, doesn't it?
Yeah, it's very close, very close.
Very close. There's no significant differences to talk about between the cost of living in those two counties. Mr. Prunty, what about Walworth?
So in Walworth County, again, over the course of 6 years, poverty increased from 12% to 14%, and ALIS increased from 20% to 25%. And again, I referenced that earlier, just how surprised I was to see that data set. Then when you break it out by household types by income, again, single or cohabitating, so you had 17% ALIS, 20% in poverty, so 37% total ALIS in poverty. Families with children, you had 30% in that ALIS threshold, and then 8% that were in poverty, so that's 38% ALIS in poverty. And again, seniors, 35% ALIS, 9% poverty, so that's 44% ALIS in poverty. So again, we continue to see this trend where it's trending higher in seniors when you break it out. And again, I think people need to pay attention to this and why it's so concerning, because it doesn't matter, quite frankly, what category it's broken out into. But it's particularly concerning when you look at seniors, because, again, these are folks who have done the right thing. They have worked hard all their lives. They've contributed to the economy. They've raised their families. And, again, here they are in a situation where there's one event away, in a lot of cases, for them to be thrown into poverty. And when you get to that point in your life, you shouldn't be living your life in that manner.
The mobility of our society and the fact that children now, for economic reasons, often migrate far from the parents also is a part of this issue too, isn't it? The nuclear family that took care of Ma and Pa, that was actually pretty common when I was a child. Okay, when I was a child in the 40s and early 50s, that was a model that worked in terms of the extended family was around. They took in Pa and took care of him. That happens, of course, still today, but it seems to me, from just my observation, far less likely. And I know there's data that backs that up. So how do we respond to these seniors? Are there special ways that we can respond to the seniors that through the public and private sectors that we should be thinking about, Mr. Prunty?
Well, I think we need to put more emphasis on providing support services for seniors. Just in my experience, you know, at United Way, we do fund programs that provide support for seniors, but we need to be looking at doing more, because that's what this data tells us. And the data needs to inform the right kind of responses to it, where folks, certainly we don't want to turn our backs on children, families, and everything else. We definitely want to continue to provide services there. But we need to be thinking about what can we do to help our seniors. And again, the key word that I continue to lift up is with intention. So we know what the data tells us. What can we do? And so we need to move swiftly to try to provide support services for this population.
As we take a look at the whole issue of poverty and near poverty and how we define it, you could have endless, endless political arguments. But I think it is worth it for our listeners to take the time to download a copy of this report, take a look at the news articles that have been in the newspaper the past week, study them, and think about what all this means, because we're cruising toward some real problems for specific sectors of our population, and for our healthiness as a society overall. This is about the quality of life, and it certainly is about the quality of our schools and the quality of our future workforce, because if we're putting kids through school without proper nutrition, without proper resources, without well-paid teachers who don't have the proper materials and training on the most effective methods, we're going to be in deep trouble in the next decades, aren't we?
Yes, definitely. And when you talk about kids in schools and having that kind of support services, whether it's nutrition or whatever else, it does remind me of something that we've been doing with in partnership with Racine Unified School District over the course of the last few years. It's an effort called Community Schools, and schools are used as hubs to provide support services for kids. So they basically look at removing the barriers to academic progress, again, whether it's nutrition. So at one of the schools that we have this partnership, we've seen an exponential increase in meals. So somewhere in the neighborhood of 500 dinners were being provided for kids after school in our first year. In year two, that number went up to over 2,300 because we were able to provide dinner meals twice a week for children and their families. We also have specific and intentional after-school programs for children based on the school improvement plan for that particular school. We also have support services for parents that they can also partake in. And so the school is non-traditional in that it's open beyond school hours. And we've seen an exponential increase in academic achievement in both reading and math with children in the school. And this is the lowest income, most poverty-stricken area in Racine County. And so we've been able to move the needle in just 2 years academically and with parental engagement. So there are models that can work.
Well, that's terrific. Is that part of the Lighted Schoolhouse movement? Is that similar?
It's in partnership with Lighted Schoolhouse. What makes this different is that what we do at United Way is we spend about a year or so doing a lot of kind of needs assessment in the neighborhood. So we find out from the parents, the teachers, people who live in the neighborhood, what do they care about? What kind of services you think should be in the school? Then again, we align it with the school improvement plan. And then we develop a set of metrics in which we measure our outcomes and progress every single year to see if we're moving the needle. And so it's a little bit more intentional. And there's about 5,000 community schools that have been implemented nationwide, and that number continues to grow. So there's 4 or 5 communities in Wisconsin that's doing this model. But this is the first of its kind in Racine County.
Are there's access to other services then available through representatives at the school site periodically then?
Yes, absolutely. So we fund partner agencies, provide specific services. We also provide services for people who live in the neighborhood as well. So it's even beyond just children and family. So that third ring is just the neighborhood in general. And we have someone at the school who works as a United Way employee who coordinates all of these different services and makes sure that things are moving along, because you just can't throw a bunch of services in there and expect it to happen kind of in a vacuum. You do have to have an on-point coordinator who is embedded within the school culture, who's providing all the kind of facilitation and coordination of these services.
Well, that's a great positive note to end on. Congratulations on that terrific program.
Thank you.
I've been speaking with Rodney Prunty, the Chief President and the Chief Professional Officer of the United Way of Racine. And you can get information about this in Kenosha County from Tara Panasiewicz, who's doing a great job here, and the new director, Dan Nordzik, in Walworth County. This is Len Iaquinta for Community Matters, urging you to read up on ALICE, Asset Limited Income Constrained Employed. Find out what it's about. Get informed, roll up your sleeves, and get involved. Good day.
You've been listening to Community Matters. All programs are archived at WGTD.org. Click shows. This is WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva.
From the WGTD Arts and Other Events calendar, Wednesday, September 5th, River Bend Nature Center will host a presentation on the common insects found around River Bend. It will be a presentation of their life and habitats, followed by a search to find them in the wild. Visit riverbendracine.org.
From the WGTD Arts and Other Events calendar, auditions for the Racine Theatre Guild Singing Soloist Spotlight Stars will be held at Holy Communion Lutheran Church on Thursday, September 6th from 5 to 8 p.m. for local high schoolers. For more information or to sign up, visit racinetheatre.org.
Support for WGTD comes from Leeward Elite. Shorten your workday, reduce stress, and re-engage with the joy of mission by removing the pain of technology. 5723 6th Avenue, Kenosha. For more information, visit leewardba.com.
Support for WGTD comes from the Racine Zoo, featuring over 100 different species on over 28 acres on the shores of Lake Michigan. Perfect fun for the entire family. Open 7 days a week, 9 to 6 p.m., with last admission at 5 p.m. Visit racinezoo.org.
Support for WGTD comes from Cricket Wireless, featuring the latest in back-to-school smartphone tech, affordable for the entire family. 34